Hello there, and welcome back to the Film Score Podcast. Today, my guest is Mike Post. Now, some of you, many of you, I think, are going to be familiar with Mike's TV work. But for those of you that aren't familiar with the 5-time Grammy winner, Mike's responsible for the theme music and underscore on shows like Law and Order, NYPD Blue, The A-Team, Magnum P.I., Quantum Leap, Rockford Files, etc., etc. I think he's done, I don't know, thousands, tens of thousands of hours of television dating back to, like, the late 60s, early 70s. And you Seinfeld fans will certainly know him. George Costanza's voicemail is a parody of Mike's theme for The Greatest American Hero. And Mike and I do touch on those, and it's something that I was tempted to really dig into, but my guess is Mike's probably talked about all those a lot over the last 50 years. Instead, we focus a lot on Mike's musical journey and really talk about his new album, which came out, I think, on April 5th, Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta. It's kind of a throwback to his Grammy-winning album, Classical Gas, which I think was the late 60s, where he fused an orchestra with rock music, and here he's fusing an orchestra with a bluegrass rhythm section and a blues rhythm section. It's pretty cool stuff. And surprisingly, I think this is the first non-TV album Mike's put out in, I don't know, 50 years maybe? 55? So it's really cool to see. I will mention, we do, maybe 5 or 6 minutes, have a discussion on race and slavery, particularly relating to the blues. Just throwing that out there for some of you folks. Now, as I mentioned, this album is currently out through Sony Masterworks, I think. And I don't think Mike actually has any social media. He's a more private guy. But of course, I do. So make sure you're following me on all those usual sites, following the podcast, and leaving me a 5-star rating and review because, of course, you want to show how much you appreciate the composers I have on here. But I hope you dig this. This was really a lot of fun chatting with Mike. So sit back and enjoy. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today. How have you been?
I'm doing well, you know, loving where everything's at for me personally and professionally, and happy as a guy can be.
that's great. I mean, and I don't know, it's got to be extra exciting having this album coming out on the horizon. As we're talking right now, I think it's about 3-4 weeks out. And if I remember right, I mean, this is your first album of purely original non-TV music since, I don't know, going back to like 69 with the Mike Post Coalition. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, my whole focus, funny, the arc of my career has been really an experience in diversity in terms of, you know, where I've been able to survive and flourish. And so, you know, started out just as a rock and roll piano player and kind of made it as a studio guitar player in the Wrecking Crew in the mid to late 60s, and then started producing records in 67 and, you know, arranging and producing. And then variety television starting in 69, I think, yep. And then film TV in 71. And ever since, really since 71, you know, my entire focus has been episodic television. You know, I've still produced records and still continued on with that. But really my real job, my day job, was doing episodic TV. So this thing is way out of the lanes that I've been cruising around in for 40 plus years, actually more like 50. But the way I look at it, a life in music is not, you know, I didn't go into this with any specific goals. I went into this, my goal was to make an honorable living doing music. So if that meant playing in a club and that was the door that opened up, that would have been great. If it meant being a studio guy, that was certainly wonderful. That was a great experience. You know, if it meant being a freelance arranger for records, that was fun. That was great. You know, if it meant being a record producer to kind of protect myself as an arranger, okay, that worked out. And, you know, honestly, I've always pictured it like the hallway at every college and university. The music department has a building that houses all the little rehearsal halls, you know, so you'd go in there by yourself or with another person or two other people and you'd do your thing. And down that hallway, there was, you know, 20 doors on each side and everybody's jamming away in there. And I always pictured my career as being in that hallway, and whatever door opened up to me, then I was going to go in there and play, you know, I was going to go in there and enjoy being part of the music. So I honestly, I never, if I had to give lessons or repair instruments or whatever opened up to me, it would have been fine. You know, this was beyond my wildest dreams. You're never going to interview a more fortunate person, you know, but it's which door opened up. The episodic television film door is what opened up. So I went through it. And then this album, these two pieces happened when that door closed and I was sitting with nothing to do because of COVID. So that's how it happened. The idea, I'm sure, you know, was probably roaming around someplace in my head. It was something waiting to happen, I think, for me personally.
And on that point, you'd spent so long on what you were writing was music for episodic television, whether theme music, score, underscore. But during that period, you know, how much of an internal buildup was there inside of you to also be writing music not for pick one of the 50 shows you've worked on, but for Mike Post instead?
Zero.
Really?
Yeah, honestly. Yeah, I'm not driven by being famous at all. In fact, quite the opposite. I love the fact that nobody knows what I look like or, you know, gives a shit. Nobody cares, you know. So, but which is fine with me. That's I like that. I've known so many giants of our business from a performance standpoint, and I don't have what they have. I don't have that desire to have people watch me perform. I certainly appreciate the fact that for 50 years, every room I walk in is filled with musicians that are really, really accomplished. And they all mostly turn to me and go, okay, how do you want this to go? You know, so I like that recognition. I do. It's not that I'm afraid of performing or I don't. It's just, you know, when the light goes on and Dolly steps into one and the light hits her, this thing happens that is just phenomenal. It's just stupendous. You know, I've known a lot of famous people, and they all have that thing. They all have that thing of when it goes on them and there's an audience there, they become something different. They levitate. They blossom like a flower, you know. Every famous person that I've worked with, you know, from Dolly to Van Halen to whoever, you know, they all have that. And I honestly don't have that. What I have is a little bit more technical within myself. You know, I'm just so addicted to the process of making music, and I'm so addicted to accomplishment. I'm restless that way. So the way this came out was not a need to do my own music, because the music I make for TV is my own music. It's just attached to somebody else's art. The way I view themes, score, underscore, whatever you want to call it for TV, they bring me their art and I put my art with it, and it makes the whole thing more artful. You know, I mean, that's my job. And I love that job. That's where I kind of blossom. I look at a picture without music and I hear music. So I'm in the right job. And the only reason this came out, honestly, was that job was put on hold by COVID. I was driving down to the desert from LA and I had a couple of hours, and I'm driving a Tesla, so it's basically driving me. And and I'm down a Spotify hole, and I don't know if you agree with me, but I think that Spotify's algorithm is just so smart. It takes you to places that they know you're going to probably like, but it's a lot of the times it's stuff I hadn't heard. So I was down this bluegrass Spotify hole, and I'm going, wow, oh yeah, listen to this, listen to that. Now, bluegrass is a music I played when I was really young. It's a music I feel really close to, and I feel fairly authentic in terms of knowing its history and knowing who and where and when and how from Monroe on. I know what happened. And this idea just struck me. You know, I did this record way back a long time ago in 1968, called Classical Gas, and the idea was orchestrated, in quotes, rock and roll. It's just guitar licks and rhythm section licks put into the orchestra, you know. At the time, it was pretty revolutionary. There was only one other guy doing it, and that's Jimmy Webb. And we both won a Grammy that year for doing it. Specifically, he won a Grammy for a record called MacArthur's Park, and I won a Grammy for Classical Gas for arranging. And his was accompanying a vocal, mine was an instrumental. You know, we're just two rock and roll guys that could read and write and were literate. And in those days, those two worlds didn't come together very much. Hmm. That was the idea he had and the idea I had at the same time. And then I was thinking about bluegrass. I'm going, you know, I don't think there's ever been a concerto written or a big piece written for the orchestra and a bluegrass rhythm section. I said, well, I'm probably the right guy to do that. I'm fairly authentic bluegrass-wise, knowledge-wise, and I'm not afraid of the orchestra. You know, I'm very comfortable with the orchestra. And then I did some research and found out nobody had done that. People had alluded to it. There's a violin concerto that's supposedly a bluegrass. It's not. It's a legit piece with a few licks that are sort of compatible, but it's not real bluegrass music at all. And you know what? When people hear this deal of mine, there's going to be a segment that goes, no, no, that's not legitimate bluegrass. Well, you're right. No, no, it's not. And there's going to be a segment of people from the symphonic world and the orchestral world that's going to go, what is this? That ain't right. You know, well, okay. You know, anyway, so, you know, halfway through sketching this stuff and kind of starting the process, I went, you know, if this works, it'll work schematic, will work for a blues band and the orchestra. So that's why there's two pieces. You know, COVID lasted long enough and kept my episodic TV schedule at bay long enough that I could complete both the pieces. So that's how it happened.
I want to go on one point you said where you think there will be a segment of people on at least the bluegrass section and maybe for the blues section as well that'll say, this isn't real bluegrass, this isn't real blues. Why do you think that is?
Well, they're correct. They're absolutely correct. You know, look, man, I've been dealing with this phenomenon since day one. It's actually a prejudice, as in prejudgment. I actually had people back in the late 50s, early 60s look at me and go, what are you doing, man? You can't play that. Why? Well, your skin's the wrong shade. Oh, really? Okay, well, you know, I guess you're entitled to your point of view, but I think that's bullshit, you know? I mean, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, oh, well, you're from the San Fernando Valley. You're a California kid. What do you know about bluegrass music? Well, I heard Bill Monroe when I was maybe 9, and I went, holy moly, listen to that, you know? And you know, when the Foggy Mountain Banjo album came out, Flat and Scruggs, the first album, I memorized every note. It just changed me, you know? So, oh, okay, well, because I'm not from Virginia or Kentucky or wherever some people think you got to be from, you know, to make bluegrass music. You know, look, those pigeonholes of, like, because I didn't go to Juilliard or I didn't go to Eastman or even North Texas State, I actually didn't go to college. Oh, man, you can't write legit music. Well, first of all, let's really talk about this for 1 second. There's 12 different notes, okay? And the 13th one's a repeat of the first one. It's called an octave. So there's only 12 of them. So let's get over ourselves and realize this is not molecular biology or quantum physics. This is finite. So I studied enough Bach to realize, oh, wait a second. When that guy died, we basically de-seed. We went right back to the top because this guy exhausted the possibilities of those 12 notes, kind of. Now, you know, I don't know that Bach foresaw everything that's available to us aurally, sound-wise, with everything that's happened electronically and digitally. I don't know that he saw that, you know. But there were some guys back there that saw the future, namely Dvorak. When I heard the New World Symphony, I was 13 or 14, and I went, oh, wait a minute, I know exactly what that is. That Largo movement, that's going home. That's an old Southern gospel song, you know. And when I researched it and found out this Dvorak was basically Jules Verne, he saw the future. You know, he saw it and he heard it. And he went, oh, I know what this all is, you know. There was a review maybe the day after it premiered in New York in 1896 or 97, something like that. And the reviewer, you know, another pigeonhole guy, Maestro Dvorak, you know, we're lucky to have him here in New York as our conductor and blah, resident composer. But you know what? He's made a terrible mistake. Certainly, he took folk melodies in Europe and he made symphonies out of them. That was the way he made his bones. That was his first Grammys. But this idiot reviewer says, but he's chosen these inferior Indian and Negro melodies to make this symphony out of. And it's too bad because he has great firepower as a composer and as an orchestrator, but he's wasted it on these melodies. So he wrote back the next day in very kind, intellectual language, fuck you, you idiot. You don't realize that in these melodies, right here in your own home, right here, homegrown in the United States of America, are the building blocks, the architectural materials to many new genres of music. Well, in 1896, he's talking about jazz, which led to rock and roll and rockabilly and bluegrass and country. And he saw the whole thing. He's Jules Verne. He saw the whole damn thing. You know, it's like a guy in, you know, in the 1800s saying, no, we're going to travel underneath the ocean in vehicles called submarines. Holy shit. Oh, we're going to be flying in the skies, you know. Okay. So, you know, there's always been this element of, well, you can't do that. That's against what we think you should do. Well, art is this open pursuit, this open way of thinking of like, okay, they can give you the rules. Here's how to do a Bach quartet. Okay, you know, no parallel fifths, no parallel octaves. Don't double the third. Okay, that's how you write a little Bach quartet. That's how Bach said you make four voices move. Those are the rules. Now break them. Go ahead and break them. See what happens. See what it sounds like. You know, that's art. So, yeah, there's going to be segments on many sides that won't like what I did, that not only won't like it, but will think that it's, in quotes, wrong. Well, guess what? I never heard any wrong music. I mean, that doesn't exist. I know it's coming, and I know if anybody even listens, I don't know that anybody's going to care enough to listen. But if they do, I think I'm hoping that the majority of people that listen to it will like it and feel something for it. And those that don't like it, that's okay.
Well, and hearing all this, I mean, I can imagine what your, you know, non-PG rated response to that would be. But look, it also seems like something you've been doing your whole career. You look at even just your TV work, where when you started, it was more kind of big band styled, and that was kind of what had been in vogue for a while. And you may disagree with this, but you are credited for really help ushering TV music out of that towards more rock style, and then again into more sort of electronic style once you hit the 90s. That's been your career of taking, okay, this is what we've been doing. Let's get more modern. Let's keep pushing forward.
Factually, I know you're right. That's 100% correct. And, you know, just to validate that even more and tell you the details, look, being tuneful and song-like, right? I didn't invent that. Me and my partner, my late partner, Pete Carpenter, didn't invent that. Mancini really invented that, okay? He really did. If you go listen to Peter Gunn or the Pig Panther or Mr. Lucky or any big moments, you know, it was Hank. But Hank's background was exactly what you said. He's a big band jazz guy. I devoured both of his instructional orchestration books. I mean, a guy who's genius. I mean, just great at his job. Really good. So I didn't help usher it in. It was me and Pete, us together. And Pete was a big band guy, my father's age. But he wanted, when he heard Classical Gas, he thought, wait a minute, I've hated this rock and roll bullshit my whole life, but man, this record's great. And we got to meet, and he said, can we get together and just exchange ideas and information? I said, yeah, you know, he had more formal training than me, and he really is bright and had taken some great lessons from some monstrous composition teachers and orchestration teachers, and he handed off a lot of that stuff to me, and I handed him, you know, what I thought was good in my world, and we were a hybrid, certainly. You know, certainly you can't say that Rockford Files or White Shadow or Magnum or any, or 18, I mean, you can't call that rock and roll, but it's certainly not big band influenced as much as it is rhythm section rock and roll influence. So you're 100% right. And you know what? It isn't that I had this big idea. It isn't that I was trying to change anything. It's just I was the right guy at the right inflection point. You know, I was the right guy at the right, this is happening. I got a shot at doing it. And I did it with the sensibility and the tools that I already had combined with this partnership.
I want to go back to a point that you said a few minutes ago about what Dvorak was saying in his response letter about the great melodies that were there in American music.
Yeah.
It seems like that's something, that was one of the, I don't know, maybe reasons or goals behind this album as well, is like to sort of continue or restart that celebration. Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a restart or continue. What it was like, okay, we got all this structure. Now, certainly after Dvorak, without Dvorak, there's no Copeland, okay? It just doesn't exist. You know, we all build on what it's RAM, okay? Like you open your ears and you feed stuff in and then, you know, you sit down and it comes out. Without Copeland, there's no Johnny Williams. Come on. You know, you just open your ears. It's like, oh, well, there's a lineage here, right?
Yeah.
So with these two pieces, you know, I'm swimming around in the same river as those guys were. It's just I got a different upbringing. I have some different input, you know, all these years. So being a rhythm section guy myself, I'm going to put a slightly different spin on it than maybe, you know, a guy that spent his whole life in a room with a cello between his legs or a fiddle in his hand, you know. It was just a chance to take these two kind of cornerstones of American musical experience. I mean, they're giant. You know, you can just say the blues or you can just say bluegrass. And yeah, but that's like say, well, you can say the Rocky Mountains. Now try and get across them on foot. You know, I mean, that's a different deal. You know, you know, I mean, honest to God, the blues, you can spend 25 lifetimes and not cover everything. You know, I mean, honestly, it's just too big. In those simple set of chord changes, you know, in that simple melodic structure is all this emotion and all this soulful, you know, it's the source of the Nile River. You know, it's like, wow, look at that. You know, so if you start at the beginning and you think about Robert Johnson and all the guys that started this thing acoustically, and you build on that in your knowledge and your appreciation, and you know, you work through Lead Belly and you work through, well, wait a second, now all of a sudden, you know, Muddy shows up and then BB, you know, I mean, you can study BB, literally study BB your whole life and never have it. It's so good. It's so deep. It's such deep water. The same's true for bluegrass. The same exact thing. It's just all this wealth of history. And so what I was looking for in these two pieces, and I think I pulled it off. I mean, for me personally, I pulled it off. And I did it a really weird way, but it was the only way to pull it off. I was looking for a conversation between the orchestra and each rhythm section. And because of COVID and because of not being able to have a live orchestra for like a year, right? I was able to mock up my first ideas in the boxes that I work in television with every day, then bring in rhythm section players one or two at a time, have them play kind of what I had written. In most cases, they don't read. Gabe Witcher reads very well, the fiddle player in the bluegrass band. He's the only one in the bluegrass rhythm section. Abe Laboriel and Abe Jr. both read. Sonny Landreth reads a little, but he doesn't really need to. His ears are so big. And Eric Gales doesn't read at all, you know. And Robert Turner, he didn't need to read. He just heard it. And, oh, okay, I can play, you know. And the way I structured it for them, certainly I showed them what the chord changes were and what the melodies were. But I was relying on those guys to be completely creative and jam, blow. Let me hear you. I want to hear you, not me. You know, I know what I sound like. I want to hear what they do with the bare bones of it. And then I went back after that and redid some of the orchestral stuff. You know, I went, oh, no, listen to that great line Sonny played on slide. That's going to be reflected in the cellos. That's going to be reflected in the French horns, you know, that blah, blah, blah. So it ended up being this call and response, this conversation. The river's flowing both ways, guys, you know. Now, in a legit world, when you sit down with a scored paper and a pencil and a piano or whatever you write on, and you start to write, you know, you're hearing the whole thing, but you're not getting the benefit of what improvisation brings to it from the rhythm section. Now, the horns and the strings and the woodwinds and the brass, all that, they're not going to jam. They're going to read. But the emotion that they bring to it is so big. And the power in numbers. When you think of how many hours, in this case, I had 80 players. And I know for a fact there was not one weak chair in the 80. Not one man or woman that was weak. They were all killers. I mean, just because they're all LA studio people and they're gunfighters. Nobody can do what they can do. They're just the best of the best. So they bring so much more than the notes on the page. I'm not trying to brag, but I'm a pretty damn good conductor. However, my baton has some degree of influence, maybe some power in it. Nothing compared to what these people can play. I mean, it's just like, you just can't believe it. You just stand there with your mouth open going, how in the world can this be this good? They never rehearsed. They just looked at it and started playing. You know, it's like, okay, let's go. So I was able to have this two-way conversation between rhythm section and orchestra that I don't know that that's happened very much at all, you know. In classical music, for years, they've tried to build this little mechanism in so that there could be freedom of a jam, freedom of, no, this is what I'm feeling right now. Those are called cadenzas, you know. They're only for soloists. So everything's written, and then they tell you, okay, let me hear what you got. Well, that's great, but that's not what I was trying to do. I'm trying to do it the way it's done in the rhythm section, which is, man, I would have never played that on guitar if that drummer hadn't have done what he did and that bass player didn't do what he did and that keyboard. But that's what making contemporary rock and roll is all about. It's about listening to each other and having the sum of it be more than what the total of the parts are. You know, it's like, wow, it's another animal, you know. So that's what I was trying to pull off. And for me, just for me, somebody else might think I'm totally full of shit, but I you know, I honest to God, that's when I hear these pieces now, I go, wow, it sounds like that. That actually sounds like they're listening and speaking.
And let's take a step back. So what was your approach when you first started putting this together? I mean, like, what did you start writing with? What were those initial ideas?
I just started hearing little bluegrass tunes, little Irish-tented, Appalachian, fiddle-oriented tunes. I had this one piece in A minor on guitar that I'd been constructing as a practice piece, just this little flat-picking thing. And I'd just been doing it at night. You know, I'm so addicted, you know. I mean, I could do 20 years in rehab and not get over it. I can work all day long in here, you know, doing a score for a television show or two TV shows or something, and go home at night and actually pick up a guitar. What a, you know, it's like, what is wrong with you, man alive? It's like, well, okay, that's just who I am. So I was messing around with this guitar piece. And then when I got this idea and I sat down, I said, I'm going to do it the old way. I'm going to pull out some score paper and some pencils and pencil sharpener and a drafting board. And okay, let's go. No computer involved, which is different because, you know, I don't do any TV without. I work with two dear friends. Andy Berkheimer is an engineer and he's on the board and he's got a computer too. But John O'Hara is responsible for all the sequencing and synthestrating, orchestrating, samplestrating, whatever you call it. Okay, so, you know, I just basically look at the picture and play and say, okay, it's about in this tempo. Let's get a groove. Let's get this. Let's pull up this loop, pull up, you know, blah, blah, blah. So as a pure composer, I think I'm more powerful on paper. I think I'm less constricted by putting my hand on a mouse or having somebody else put his hand on a mouse and her hand, whoever, you know. No, it's just me and the notes, you know. Okay, well, I'll sit down and do it that way. So I just came up with these three or four little tunes in addition to this one A minor guitar thing. So once I had the chunks, and I just had them in little chunks, just 1 minute of this, 30 seconds of that, a minute and a half of this, 2 minutes of this. And I brought them in to my work, and I asked John to come to work, even though we didn't have any shows. So he showed up, and I said, here. And he said, what is this? And I said, well, here's the idea. He goes, whoa, wait a minute. You mean this is we're going to have a bluegrass band come in here and play these tunes, and we're going to orchestrate? I said, yep, that's what we're going to do. And he went, oh, this is great. I'm in. I said, great, great. So you're going to help me, and you're going to help me. And he's very well educated, you know, has a undergraduate from Vanderbilt in music and a graduate degree from Berkeley in, you know, Valencia, Spain. And he's really well educated. He's a double-fisted, classically trained, excellent pianist, okay? Hmm. Now, he also knows rock and roll. He knows jazz. He's very well-versed. So I said, look, we're both going to orchestrate, but I want you to be part of this. I don't want you to feel like you're just, you know, executing my ideas. I want to hear some of your ideas. So lo and behold, he has a chunk of this as a composer as well. And he did a great job, really great job. So we orchestrated those chunks. Then we brought in bluegrass players and we had them play. Then I wrote more and then we did the same thing. And then based on what they played, we changed the orchestration and we changed what happened. Even compositionally, we took some of their licks and put them in the orchestra. And then we played the orchestral stuff from the boxes to the bluegrass players. And they changed what they were going to play. And then we put connective tissue together that I just called the glue. Because I had these tunes, but I needed stuff to tie it together. And the more I did it, I didn't know whether it was a 15-minute piece, a suite, or a rhapsody of this. I didn't know what the hell it was, you know. Well, it got to be 30 minutes. I go, well, I guess it's a concerto. I guess that's the right definition in terms of legit stuff. And halfway through, I knew right away it would work with the blues because I didn't hate it, you know. So I'd always said, if I hate this, I'm not doing it, you know. But halfway through, I thought, God, this is a pretty damn good idea. And nobody's done it, you know. And I had genius, genius rhythm section people, bluegrass people, starting, you know, with one of my oldest and dearest friends. We went on the road together when we were 19, 18, actually, named Herb Peterson, who's a genius banjo player, and another old and dear friend of mine that I met years and years ago through Herb, Gabe Witchers, the fiddle player. He led me to his brother, who is a monstrous dobro player. And a guy named Patrick Sauber filled out that rhythm section because he's just a giant talent as a mandolin player and a flat picking guitar player. And he's just authentic. He's just great at both of those. So, you know, we didn't need any more. That was all I needed.
And how did you settle on those folks to make up the bluegrass rhythm section? And then the same thing with how did you determine who would be in the blues section? Because I am sure your address book, your Rolodex is filled with just great, great players.
It is. My life is. My life is filled with monstrous talent, just overflowing talent. It's just like casting a movie or a TV show. That in itself is a challenge, and honestly, it's actually a talent. The bluegrass thing was pretty easy, honestly, because of Herb. You know, we've been friends forever. I produced two albums on Epic years ago on him as an artist, and we're just dear, dear, really close friends. So I called him on the phone. I said, hey, how you doing? I got nothing going on in COVID. You know, I'm not working much and blah, blah, blah. I said, well, I got an idea. And I told him the basic idea, and he goes, oh, God. Damn, this is gonna be so hard, you know. And Herb can read a chord sheet very well. I mean, he's a good guitar player, rhythm section guy. He worked on Rockford for years. He worked on a lot of TV with me. He can't so much read notes, but he can read a chord sheet very, very well. When the red light goes on, he doesn't even flinch, you know. He's a gunfighter, you know, like all studio musicians that's what we live for, you know. It's like, okay, let's go, you know. But he, you know, this scared him. He goes, oh, God damn, you know, I said, Herb, I promise, it looks complicated. It might even sound complicated some of the time. It's not. It's just 12 notes. That's all we got to choose from. Calm down. I'll get you through this. When you break it down into its parts, it's pretty straightforward. Don't worry about it. I got you, you know. And so, actually, we did Herb, and I figured if we did Herb and Patrick together and then brought Gabe in? Or did we do Herb and Gabe together? I forget. Anyway, we did two of them, then we did everybody else individually, and it was so much fun because of the talent. On the blues side, it was the exact same procedure. You know, it's like, okay. Now, no, I've left part of that out. I had this race thing to deal with, okay? Because the last thing I wanted, I'm ready for the legit guys to not like it because it ain't legit enough. I'm ready for the blues/bluegrass guys to not like it because it ain't authentic, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't want to take a lot of shit on writing music for the orchestra based on the blues for riding in on a white horse and taking somebody's music and, you know, being, you know, like what Paul Simon got accused of with Graceland. And wrongly, completely wrongly. You know, those are Paul Simon songs. Now, are they influenced by all these terrific players from Africa? Absolutely. But it doesn't sound like African music. It sounds like Paul Simon music influenced and played with these sensibilities. Okay, so, but I've always been sensitive to the responsibility of, wait a minute, what really made the blues? Well, slavery made the blues. The worst thing in the you want to know how bad humans can be? Well, let's start with that. Let's go to the Holocaust next, you know? I mean, it's like, wow, what's wrong with Homo sapien? What is wrong with us? Anybody with a right mind knows that you scoop up a bunch of people, take away their freedom, and kill them, half of them, put them in chains, put them on a boat, take them to a foreign country, take away their language, their religion, their dance, their art, their music, take away everything, put them behind a plow, make them a mule, make them make you money off of what you can plant and they can harvest. And you know what? That ain't going away in 100 years or 200 years. I don't know if that's ever going away. The ripples from that boulder going into the pond. Now, did it produce the blues? Yeah. Is that a great thing? No. It's hardship. It's inhuman. It's beyond. There's no word for it. There's no word to describe what that did to these African people. There's no word to describe what it's done to their ancestors. Well, there's no words. There's just no words. It's beyond description. Well, okay, so the blues was born of that. As a guy with pink skin, whose ancestors are from Europe, I'm not going to write in here and say, hey, you know, listen to me. I'm playing the blues. I just can't. I got to be careful with that inside myself. I can't. I got to be able to look in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with Abe Jr., you know, who's just this decorated McCartney's drummer. Okay, let's just start with that. But there's so much. There's so much more. That kid, I've known him since he was very young, and that kid is just a mountain of talent. So I told him, I said, hey, look, I'm dealing with something here. I've written this thing, and I think it's good. I know it's good. God damn it, it's good. And you need to play drums on it. So, okay, I'm in. I said, but look, I got this responsibility that I feel. Now, maybe nobody else will feel it, but I feel it, and I got to look in the mirror. I said, so everybody I hire, some of their ancestors got to trace back to Africa. So, you know, we just chatted about who'd play guitar and who'd play keyboards and blah, blah, blah. I said, I know this guy, you know. I said, he's really more Mexican than anything. He's certainly more Mexican than he is African. But I said, his skin's pretty dark. And I said, who do you think ought to be the bass player? And he just laughed, you know. He said, have you called my dad yet? And I said, no, I want to call you first. And, you know, I'm calling him. I know he's going to do it, you know. I said, but I wanted to make sure you were available and you wanted to do it. And he said, well, of course I want to do it. So he was great about it. And I called Abe, and a senior, and we laughed. And, you know, and then I really looked around for a slide player whose ancestors are from Africa that was as good as Derek Trucks or Sonny Landreth. And I couldn't find one. And Sonny's my dear friend. I produced an album on him. He played at my wedding. You know, I mean, I've known him really a long, long time. And I feel really close to him. I've never met Derek Trucks, although I have tremendous respect for him. I love him. I'm a huge fan. And, you know, there's other good slide players, you know. I mean, there's Kev Moe can play, and, you know, a lot of guys can play. But somebody that could play and be comfortable in this orchestra surrounding, you know, Sonny's the guy. So he's sort of my token white guy, you know. And Eric Gales, I'd never work with him, but he's as different and as distinctive as anybody out there. And to me, it's like, wait a minute. It's like almost like, wow, he's actually Jimi Hendrix. I mean, he's that good. He's that badass. And he's different. He's upside down and backwards. Jimmy was just upside down, right? You know, except he restrung the guitar, right? But, you know, he wasn't backwards, you know. Eric is backwards. Takes a regular guitar and plays it left-handed. It's just like, it's like, wow, that's so different. And his vibrato, nobody shakes the way he shakes. It's so fast, and it's so wide and fast. And he's got these chops, you know. I mean, the guy just, he can play a million notes or he can play five. And it's all going to be Eric Gales. So, you know, he was just a blessing. This kid, Robert Turner, I've known for 5, 6, 7 years. I actually heard him in a piano bar at a steakhouse in Encino.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I just started listening to him, and I went, who in the hell is this? And I walked over, and I said, hi, how you doing? I got his attention. I stuck a $100 bill in his tip jar, and he went, oh, well, thank you very much. I said, no, listen, you're really unusual. You're a giant player. And he goes, are you a musician? I said, I am. And then I told him, well, I know who you are. And, well, I know your music. And I said, well, yeah. I said, so I want you to come over and meet with me. I want to know about you. And so he did, you know, and we became friends. And he would, you know, send me CDs that he was doing with a jazz thing or a gospel thing. And he plays in church, you know, 2-3 days a week. So he's a legitimate guy. I mean, he's with huge chops. So, you know, he's perfect guy. So that's how all the casting came together for that.
And I know we're running a little out of time, but I mean, because this is such an unusual project, what was their reactions in hearing things once it had all been put together?
I think I know that they were like, wow, that actually works. I mean, it's unusual. You know, some of them were terrified, you know, because it's so out of their usual routine. But they calm down because they're all great players and they're all gunfighters. Yeah. They're all, you know, I don't care how much they were like, holy shit, this is so foreign, you know. Once they got to playing and then they saw that I was reflecting what they played, and then once I replaced all the boxes with 80 maniacs, you know, that are just so talented, you know, and then I mixed it. The mixing process took a while, and then I sent it out to everybody, and they were all super complimentary. I think they're proud. I honestly believe that it's, you know, in various ways and their own individual feelings. I think they're proud. I know that they've expressed to me that they were happy they were involved.
That's great. I mean, and I don't know, I guess what more could you want for them to be proud and happy?
Nothing, Nick. Honest to God, that's the home run. Now, if the public, you know, if anybody likes it or cares about it, that makes me happy. But I'm filled up already. Number one, the musicians liked it. The orchestral musicians seemed to really like it, and they really played it so naturally and so well, which was different from 40 years ago, trust me, you know. And you want to hear my little speech to the orchestra before we played a note?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I got up. This is at the Sony scoring stage. You know, I got up and I said, hi, you know, I'm so glad you all came and thank you for showing up. We're going to be here 2 days. We got an hour's worth of music to get through. Some of it's actually hard to play. And some of it's pretty complex. I said, but here's my hope. I'm one of you. I'm an LA studio guy, rhythm section, wrecking crew, 60s. That's when I did your job. I know your job. I know your ancestors. I worked beside them. And I must say, in the old days, it was always us in the rhythm section and you guys in the orchestra. And certainly we're all musicians. We all belong to the same local. We're all brothers and sisters. But a little bit, it was us and you. And as a conductor all those years for TV, it was always orchestrally pulling on a bungee cord or trying to stop a runaway freight train. And what I'm hoping is, it doesn't need to be this way, but I'm hoping that unlike your ancestors who had just been raised on classical music and that were now coming in to interface with the rhythm section and play some licks that were actually started in the rhythm section and now we've got to play it in the fiddles and the orchestra, I'm hoping that you're different. I'm hoping that your ears have been opened up and that while you were studying, you know, Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, that you were also listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I'm hoping that the time, the feel, is not so foreign to you as it was to your ancestors, to your moms and dads and uncles and aunts. That's my hope. I don't need that, because I certainly made some good music with your moms and dads and uncles and aunts. But I'm hoping that you can kind of dig this, that you kind of go like, oh, I know what this is. And I said, of course, we're going to find out, aren't we? Here we go. And I held my hands up. And they all went like, okay, this guy's not fucking around, you know. So, you know, and I wasn't. And I wasn't challenging them really, but kind of. You know, I was going, okay, come on, guys. You know what? I'm not telling you this is easy, but the only way you're going to do it is watch me and listen. Listen carefully. So each piece, I had it all divided in chunks. I said, don't play. Read along, but listen to what we accomplished in the boxes, but especially listen to these rhythm sections. And so each piece, we did that. We'd listen together. Mm-hmm. And then we'd play. And after 10 minutes, I put the baton down. I said, put your instruments down. I said, you're unbelievable. This is everything I could ever hope for and more. This is more than I dreamed about. You belong in the rhythm section, or the rhythm section belongs in your sections. My dreams have been realized. That's exactly how it happened.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. And for what it's worth, you were saying how great it is that the rhythm section liked it, the orchestra liked it. if it gives you any extra mileage, I really dug it too. It's a really cool project. And I think a big part of that comes from your passion for it and how much everyone playing on it enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, I hope so, man. I hope so. Honestly, right now, I wouldn't say I'm satiated, but I am certainly completely satisfied that the musicians, my friends, my family, people that I really, really respect. I sent this to a few of my dear friends really early on when it was still in the boxes and rough mixes and all. But, you know, to get a response from Alan Silvestri and Tommy Newman and people like that and Mike Gorfain and Sam Schwartz and people that really know, you know, going like, oh, no, this is really good. This is really different and really good. You know, I mean, okay, so I checked all the boxes that I had invested emotionally, you know, and if anything happens past this, that's great. That's fantastic. And if it doesn't, okay, I still feel good about it.
Great. Well, and look, all that said, I hope it gets a great response. It deserves it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I don't, yeah. I, honest to God, listen, some of the best records I ever made, nobody ever heard. And some of the records I walked out going, yeah, I'm not, I don't know, is that any good? You know, oh, I love that. You know, so rarely does the artist really know anything about what is going to happen on a widespread public thing. It's not our job, you know, and nobody knows anyway, you know, nobody's can predict that, but I'm hopeful. And like I said, so far I'm satisfied, really am satisfied.
You know, maybe it's like they said in Unforgiven, you know, deserves got nothing to do with it.
Right. That's exactly right.
But Mike, I really appreciate your time. It was, you know, it was great chatting with you. I had to make sure I didn't, you know, spend our whole hour talking about the insane amount of great TV work you've done, but I certainly could have.
Listen, you know, I don't mind talking to you about it, and if you want to talk about that another day, I'll be glad, but I appreciate you having me.
No, absolutely, and I won't take up any more of your time, because I'll say, if you open the floodgates, there's no stopping it, so maybe we'll save that for another time.
Yeah, I'll be available to you. I enjoyed speaking with you, Nick. Thank you very much.